The Laura Murphy Show, Episode 10.
Welcome to The Laura Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Hello, everyone. This is what normally would be episode 10 of the Laura Murphy Show, but Carlos is traveling this week, and I thought, you know, instead of trying to get a substitute guest and so on, why don't we just go ahead and play a little blast from the past, but not the too distant past. This is from February 27th, 2016. This is the audio of a talk I gave at the International Students for Liberty Conference in Washington, D.C. So the topic is Ludwig von Mises' contributions to economic science and the promotion of liberty. What I'm drawing on here is I have a book that came out recently called Choice, and that's from the Independent Institute, in which I go through and distill the most important parts of Mises' famous book, Human Action. So for those of you who don't know, Ludwig von Mises is a champion leader of the Austrian School of Economics. Of course, that's a huge component of what Carlos and I do here at the Laura Murphy Show. And so I thought it'd be good for some of you perhaps to hear this, where I'm just starting from scratch and explaining why is it that so many people, even to this day, are so gaga over this guy, Ludwig von Mises, who was writing primarily in the mid-20th century in terms of popularizing the Austrian views for a broader audience. So Mises was a professional academic economist, made some great contributions, but then he also recognized the importance of teaching the lessons of sound money and private property for the public, because it's not enough just that a few economists know what's going on, that the masses need to know. And Mises, among his other traits, was good at communicating that particular insight as well. The fact that you need to teach basic economic principles to the public, because if the public holds erroneous views, it doesn't really matter what a few guys over here in the academy think. Public policy, government actions are going to be driven by what the public wants. And so that's why it's so critical to not only make these pioneering discoveries and advancements in pure economic theory, but to occasionally circle back and make sure the public understands the big picture. So with that introduction, I now invite you to listen to my talk given in late February 2016 at the International Students for Liberty Conference on the contributions of Ludwig von Mises to economic science. Hope you enjoy it. Thank you, everyone. What I'm going to be talking about is, as the introduction suggested, is my book, Choice. What it is, just so you know, the Independent Institute approached me and they said, we think that Ludwig von Mises' book, Human Action, is the best, or at least one of the most important economics books of the 20th century, but it's a bit intimidating. It's pretty long. I think it's over 900 pages, and Mises uses very formal language, right? So he wrote it in English, but it's, in other words, it wasn't just translated, but nonetheless, it's a very Germanic style, very, you know, big intimidating sentences. And so, unfortunately, I think a lot of people look at it and they don't even start it. And so so the idea was to say, take this thing, distill it down into something that could plausibly be assigned to an undergraduate economics class. And that's what we did. So I'd like to say that we did succeed in that. And so for this talk, I'm going to just give you three main contributions that Mises made to economic science, so you understand, you know, what is the big deal. Like, you probably heard there's the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. There's a bunch of Mises Institutes in other countries that have sprouted up around the world. And so in case you've never heard someone just explain it from scratch, is to say, what's the big deal with this one person? Why are we focusing so much on him? That's what I want to do in this talk, is to give you some of his main contributions. Okay, so first, let me just explain, though, before I get into the three main contributions, I want to explain why is it that Mises called his book Human Action, because that's a little bit mysterious itself if you're not familiar with his framework. So the idea is Mises thought that he was trying to define the scope of economic science. You know, what is it that we economists do? And then once he realized what it was, you know, it's not that they study money. That's too narrow. It's not that economists just study
business decisions. That's not it either, right? And so Mises was trying to figure out what is it that we do, and he hit upon saying what the contribution of economists has been thus far. You know, if you looked at historically the things that were the great treatises in economic science, he said that it's something unique, right? We're not doing history, but we're also not just doing pure mathematics either, right? We're not doing empirical science also. This isn't physics or chemistry or astronomy. He's saying there's something that we're doing here, and it's, let's call it economics. And he realized that we are studying the implications of the fact that humans act purposefully, or that they choose purposefully. All right, and so here, that's the what human action means in this context. Okay, so it's opposed to reflexive behavior. Okay, so it's not just anything that human bodies do in the world. It's rather things that we're going to interpret as analysts as being the result of a logical, purposeful choice. So that's why also, so my book from the Independent Institute, we called Choice, is that's a different way of homing in on what is it that Mises thought was the locus of what is then considered to be more narrow economic topics. All right, so again, just to summarize, Mises was developing what he called it was praxeology, if you've heard that term. So it's the study of action per se, that people use means to achieve ends. And then he thought the best developed branch of that or component of praxeology was what people typically call economics. Okay, so let me tell you what the three things are going to be so you can sort of pace yourself. I'm going to talk about how Mises unified micro and macro economics. I'm going to tell you how he contributed to the critique of socialism. And then I'm going to wrap up with showing you how he, in my view, gave the best explanation of what causes the business cycle in modern market economies. All right, so as far as the unifying micro and macro, that's, I don't know if any others have described it like that. That's the way I'm describing it, and you'll see why in a minute what I mean by that. You need to first understand historical context. So the classical economists, people like Adam Smith, David Ricardo, David Hume, they adopted what was considered to be a labor theory or a cost theory of value. All right, and so some people are surprised when they hear this. They think that Karl Marx was the inventor of the labor theory of value, and he wasn't. All right, so according to some classifications, people might say Karl Marx was a classical economist in the tradition of free market icons such as the people I've mentioned. And so I'm going to just make it sort of intuitive for the purposes of this talk. Obviously, if you go and read these economists, it's going to be more nuanced, but just to show you the contrast in the two different ways of explaining market prices, the classical way would say something like, okay, you know, why is it that a bottle of wine is so expensive in the marketplace? What, you know, it costs $100, why is that? And they'd say the classical labor theory or cost theory of value would explain it and say, well, look, to make that wine, you need to have grapes that were grown in the vineyards, and that land is expensive, and you got to, you know, pay the workers to go and cultivate it and then pick the grapes and go through all the process of turning it into wine, and then you got to store it and so on. So there's a lot of high cost of production. There's a lot of labor expense involved. And so because it's so expensive to make this bottle of wine, that's why they have to charge at least $100, or else they would lose money and they wouldn't do it anymore, right? So the classical cost or labor theory of value started with the expense of the inputs and used that as the causal explanation for why does this final thing in the marketplace that consumers buy, why is it fetch the price that it does? All right, and so you can see the logic behind that. Like what I just said was a true statement, right? If you're not charging enough to at least meet your expenses, your cost of production, you would stop doing that. All right, so there was a certain logic behind it. But the problem is, and I won't get into it now because I want to focus more on what Mises did, but you run into a lot of difficulties if that's the way you start out and try to explain market prices that way. And so what happened, that was overturned, right? That was the classical approach. In most fields of human knowledge, classical means wrong, right? That it's like, oh, that's the way they used to think. That's not how we think of it anymore. And so what was overturned in was what's called during the marginal revolution. So this was in the early 1870s that this happened. It's also, incidentally, that's where the term, if you know Tyler Cowen and Alex Tabarek's blog, the Marginal Revolution, that's where they get that phrase from. You guys didn't think I'd be talking about the internet, but I am. This is bonus. You write that down. So that's where their name comes from. So for economists, the marginal revolution, again, refers to this period in the early 1870s when the old classical labor theory or cost theory of value was finally, you know, they put the nail in the coffin of that and replaced it with the modern subjective value, marginal utility approach to explaining market prices. Okay, so very briefly, you know, what are they replacing it with? They're saying, for that simple example I was using, why is a bottle of wine fetching $100 in the marketplace? Well, it's because consumers enjoy drinking wine, right? You start with, you know, the first part of the explanation is to say consumers get utility from buying bottles of wine. That's why the price is what it is. That's how we would explain it. And then from there, you can work backwards and say, because bottles of wine, at least this in terms of these quantities, can fetch such and such dollars in the marketplace, that's why farmers will plant grapes. You know, looking ahead and saying, if we can use grapes to make the wine, and then we can sell the wine down the road for such and such because the consumers get a certain amount of utility or enjoyment from the wine. And so that's why we'd be willing to pay these prices to rent farmland or to buy farmland from the sellers and to plant grapes and so on. Okay, so the causal mechanism flows the other way around. It's you start with the consumer prices, and then that helps you explain why certain factors of production have the prices that they do. Okay, so it completely flipped things. And one of the, there were three economists involved in the so-called marginal revolution to give us that flip. And one of them was Karl Menger, who is considered the founder of the modern Austrian school. Okay, so at this, and that spread around in economists like that. And so you got to the point by the, going early into the 20th century, where economists, the default way they would explain exchange ratios in the marketplace in a system of barter, like to say, why is it that one apple trades for two oranges? That's the explanation they would use. They would start with subjective marginal utilities from consumers, and then they could spin out the explanation. Obviously, I'm skipping all the details, but that's the way they would do it to be able to say things like, oh, this is why in the marketplace in equilibrium, one orange trades for two apples, or you know, one horse trades for this many sheep, and so on. They would explain it starting with subjective values of consumers, and then they would build things upon that. But there, I mean, obviously that's not how actual prices are quoted in the marketplace. Most people do not go buy apples by trading oranges and vice versa. Everything has money on one side of the transaction. And so it wasn't really enough just to say, okay, we can explain using these principles, and it's a very satisfactory mechanism, the real exchange ratios. It's not enough just to say one apple trades for two oranges and vice versa. You really want to know, okay, well, how many shillings does an apple trade for or oranges trade for? And so here, the economists, even those in the Austrian tradition, Menger and you know his disciples, they ran into what they thought was an insurmountable problem. And so this is why, at this point, I would say that micro was separated from macro, that they had two completely different mechanisms to explain pricing. If they were just talking about real barter trades, they would use this new subjective marginal utility framework to explain the ratios. But then if they wanted to pop on absolute dollar prices, to not just say one apple trades for two oranges, but to say how many units of money does the apple and the oranges trade for, and you know the ratio of course would be 2-to-1, they came up with this whole separate framework, and they would use things like saying, how much total money is there? What's the velocity of circulation? And they would talk about it like that, right? So you may have seen those like MV equals PQ, that kind of framework, all right? So if you just stop and think about it, regardless of whether you think that's a good idea or not, or a good approach, I'm saying the point is they had two distinct theories. One was just to explain these micro relationships, and the other then was to say, okay, looking at the economy as a whole, how do we explain like the level of prices? Okay, not just the relative amount, but the absolute level. And it was a completely distinct set of arguments and analysis. Okay, so what Mises did was to say, we don't need to do that. We don't need to explain dollar prices, or he didn't say dollars, but you know what I mean, the money prices in terms of these things that we wouldn't use elsewhere, right? So if we're trying to explain car prices or something, Mises said, you wouldn't talk about how many total cars are there in the economy, what's the turnover of cars. Economists don't talk like that anymore. You look at marginal subjective utility decisions on the margin, And so why is it that when it comes to pricing money, if you will, to say the exchange value of money, how come we're using this completely separate framework? So the reason that they hit the stumbling block, and then I need to explain what the problem was and then show you how Mises solved it. The reason they ran into this problem, the reason even economists who thought Menger was great and took this, you know, this new marginal subjective utility approach to pricing, the reason they thought that the one area where that really doesn't work is money, is they thought you would run into a circularity problem. Okay, so they said it makes total sense. If we want to say why does one apple trade for two oranges, it makes sense to say because ultimately people get utility from eating oranges or apples or using them to bake pies or whatever, make orange juice. It makes sense to start at that, the ground floor, that people get utility. We don't care why, but for whatever reason, they get utility from these things and then to build up from there. And we can come up with a theory of market pricing that way. They thought that makes sense, that that sort of exogenous, the thing we're given as economists is what their subjective preferences are for various quantities of fruit or horses or whatever, bottles of wine. That makes sense, that we take that as a given and then start building up our theory of market pricing from that. But they said the one area where that doesn't, it seems like we're cheating or we're just doing something slippery, is if you say, why do people value units of money? Because there, clearly the main reason they do, the reason somebody would give up a house in exchange for a bunch of pieces of paper money, for example, it's not because they want to go eat the paper money. It's not because they want to build a fire with it and so on, right? So it's not that you're getting direct subjective utility from the money. Clearly, the reason you value the money, even subjectively, in the vast majority of cases, except for, you know, weird individuals like, you know, Scrooge McDuck who likes to go swimming in it, is that the reason you value the money is because you're anticipating, I can go in the marketplace and buy things with this, all right? And just to motivate that, if you went into a coma, and then you know, you go out with us karaokeing tonight and you're totally blacked out, you wake up 30 years later and you haven't seen prices yet, and someone comes up to you and says, hey, do you want to mow my lawn for $50? At first you might say, that sounds like a good deal, but you might say, well, wait a minute, let me go look and see what's the purchasing power of money, because for all you know, $50, you know, buys you a Coke at that point or something. So, well, Coke would probably be illegal by that point, but you know what I'm saying. All right, So the point is, in order for you to know how much do I value a $10 bill, you need to have some idea of what do I think I can get in the marketplace with this thing. Okay, so the economists, even in the tradition of Menger, thought we can't just directly take the subjective marginal utility approach that we use to explain barter pricing, barter ratios, and explain absolute money prices, because clearly the main thing that you need to know in order to say how much do I subjectively value a $10 bill is what does a $10 bill get me in the marketplace? So it looks like what you're saying is, oh, we're gonna explain the price of a $10 bill, like what it exchanges for in the marketplace, by saying people subjectively value it. And how do people subjectively value it? Well, because they know how much it buys in the marketplace. So it looks like you're just arguing in a circle, right? Whereas, again, it's with the other goods, it didn't seem like you hit that problem. To say people, you know, an orange or an apple trades for two oranges because people value them, there the valuation has to do with because you're going to eat it or use it to bake a pie or make orange juice. And so it doesn't seem like you're relying on the purchasing power of oranges and apples in the step one in order to then explain its purchasing power. Okay, so that's what the stumbling block was. It seemed like you would just be arguing in a circle, and that's why, until Mises came along, even people in the what we would now call the Austrian tradition thought you can't use this new approach when it comes to money itself. You can use it for every other commodity, but not money. Okay, so how did Mises solve that? He said, first of all, you got to be more careful and nuanced with the timing. Strictly speaking, what we're doing as economists is we're explaining the purchasing power of money today by reference to people's expectations about its purchasing power tomorrow. Right, so right now, if someone says, hey, do you want to mow my lawn for $50? And you stop and think, huh, what could $50 get me? You're thinking if I get paid and then in the future go into the marketplace. So if a $50 bill is able to hire a lawn cutter right this moment, you're explaining its current purchasing power, not by reference to its current purchasing power, but by reference to the expectation of its future purchasing power, okay? And then Mises said, so where do you get those expectations from? Well, it's from your observations of the immediate past. All right, so thus far, that's how he, in this first move, breaks out of the circularity problem. He said it's not that we're using the purchasing power of money to explain the purchasing power of money. That would be circular. Instead, he's saying the purchasing power today of money is based on expectations of its purchasing power tomorrow, which are formed by our observations of its purchasing power yesterday. Again, I'm speaking loosely for your benefit, but that's the logic of the argument. So that's not circular, right? Those are three separate concepts. Okay, but then the critics can come back and say, all right, fine, it's not a circularity problem, but now it's just an infinite regress. Because if you say yesterday where the purchasing power of money come from, you, Mises, would say it came from the day before yesterday, you know, observing what could money buy, and you would just go back forever. And so this is still a logical problem. You haven't solved it. You can't use this marginal utility approach to money itself. And so then Mises solved that, and he said, no, it doesn't go back forever. You trace it back step by step until it hits the point at which we're in a state of barter, where people aren't using money. And at that point, because historically that must have happened at some point, you know, money hasn't existed forever, at that point, we economists already know how to explain, using subjective marginal utility analysis, exchange ratios in a marketplace where things are, you know, directly traded against each other. There's not this intermediary of money. Okay, so that was the way he solved the problem, and that the label that has been given to that explanation is called the regression theorem. So another way you may have heard it being motivated is to say that, according to Mises, money emerged not because anyone planned it this way, and Karl Menger also came up with this theory, but that people were just trading things in the marketplace for what they directly wanted to use, and then because some things had a bigger market, more people needed eggs than wanted telescopes, for example, if you wanted to get rid of something, you know, if you wanted to sell something and ultimately you wanted a telescope, but you couldn't find anyone who had a telescope and had what you wanted, you might trade for an intermediate thing. You might sell your thing for eggs, knowing a lot of people like eggs. So historically, before money existed, people would gravitate and tend to trade what, you know, what they had to offer, and then they would be willing to accept things that were more marketable or saleable or liquid, if you know those terms. And so if you just think through the logic of that, step by step over time, there would be a premium for things that a lot of people valued. And then more and more people would be willing to accept those things, knowing, oh, a lot of people like this stuff as a temporary intermediate position. And that's where money came from spontaneously. It's just that logic, that process, if it snowballs. And so Mises said historically, things like gold and silver were very convenient because of their properties, that, you know, that it was easy to verify what they were. You know, you could divide them pretty finely. You could then put them back together. They were easy to store and so on. Okay, so that's how Mises explained where money came from. But ultimately, he's saying things that emerged from the marketplace as monies before had some standard use. They were just regular commodities. People valued gold and silver for their ornamental or industrial uses even before they began to be used as money. Okay, so that is where that explanation comes from. I don't have time to get into it today. I can, afterwards, if people care, we can talk about it. Incidentally, that's why some people who like Mises are skeptical of Bitcoin. If you've seen that in your travels, that's where it comes from. Or if you see people say, oh, Mises' regression theorem shows Bitcoin can't be money, I'm just pointing out that that's where they're coming from. So that's an interesting issue, and we can talk about that later. I'm not weighing in on that particular controversy, but I'm just showing you that's what they have in mind, because they're saying Mises showed he can explain money prices if ultimately things get traced back to the point when everything was just barter. Okay, so that's the sense in which I'm saying he unified micro and macro, that he said we can use the same framework to explain how people value things, whether we're talking about oranges or we're talking about pieces of money. Mises used the same framework. And so he could explain why is it that oranges, you know, not just that one orange trades for two apples, but that it has a price of $1 a pound versus 50 cents a pound for the apples. You know, why is it? Why isn't it $10 a pound versus $5 a pound for the apples? You know, what's the level? Mises could explain that in the same way. He would just look at, you know, the marginal utility of units of money as well. And he wouldn't run into any logical contradictions. So it was the same value framework applied to everything. Okay, so let me move on now to the critique of socialism. So here, again, to understand Mises' contribution, you need to know what the state of the debate was before he showed up. So here, historically, of course, Mises was not the first person to criticize socialism. But up till him, a lot of the arguments had been along the lines of saying, well, power corrupts, right? That you can't give the government this much power over resources and the ability to tell people who's going to get food and where they're going to live and where they're going to work and what schools their kids are going to go to. If you give a group of humans that much power, bad things are going to happen. Just look at history, right? So, that's, in my view, a perfectly defensible criticism, and that alone would be decisive. But the critics would come back and say, no, that it's, you know, we've grown up in this capitalist age, and we're going to have the right people in charge, right? So if you're worried about the bad people being in charge, fix the system by which we choose the rulers. Don't condemn the economic system of socialism. Okay, the critics also said there's an incentive problem, right? If, loosely speaking, people are expected to work and contribute to the total social output, and then the authorities use some method of distributing that output that isn't based on who actually produced each part of it, so that some people are going to contribute a lot more, but then only get a little bit of back and vice versa, that's going to ruin the incentives. That why would people show up to the factories and really work as hard as they possibly could if they know whether they work twice as hard or just, you know, lay back and just do the bare minimum, their family's going to get the same amount of food and cars and so on. What incentive is there to really push yourself? And also, how do you figure out who does the really distasteful jobs? Like, a lot of people would rather work in a library than be a garbage collector. And so if you're not allowed to adjust the compensation accordingly, well, then how is that going to work? Why wouldn't everybody just do the real nice things, and who's going to pick up the trash? Okay, so that, again, could be just labeled as the incentive problem. Again, perfectly valid objection, and that alone, I think, it would also be decisive. And you can see how a decentralized market economy solves both those problems, where the government isn't in charge of who gets food and where you live and where you work. You just leave those decisions to individuals to come up with voluntary solutions. And the incentive problem, of course, in a market economy is handled adequately as well. Okay, but Mises came along with what a lot of his fans think is an even more decisive objection. And the reason it's good is that not only does it show you what's wrong with socialism, but it also underscores his understanding of how a market economy works in a way that a lot of even professional economists nowadays, I think, don't fully appreciate, just because in their models, the way modern economists, you know, getting PhDs from top universities, solve an economic model and come up with an equilibrium and so on, they abstract away from a lot of what happens in the real world market process. And so they would miss this. And that's why a lot of intellectuals, even trained economists historically, were in favor of socialism. So that I would say it's because they didn't really understand how market economies work. And so they could see certain imperfections. There were certain things of a market economy that were distasteful to them. And they thought, well, if we just tweak the institutional framework, we can get rid of those things and we won't sacrifice the obvious plenty that market economies are showering upon us, because according to their models of how economies work, that you wouldn't sacrifice that. But again, Mises, his critique underlined what it is that market economies actually in the real world do and how they work. And thus he showed why socialism would fail. So what was his critique? Again, I'm boiling it down for our purposes here. Mises said, let's stipulate for the sake of argument that the people in charge are completely benevolent and all they want to do is use society's resources to best help everybody. Let's also stipulate for the sake of argument that they have an idea of how the individuals in the society evaluate various possible combinations of consumer output. Like, so we can say whether it would be better to have more automobiles versus more diapers, or, you know, versus more movie theaters, restaurants, things like that. Let's assume we can solve those problems. And he said, further, let's assume everybody, once the socialist plan is published, that everybody in society is a dutiful comrade and whatever, and just wants to help everybody and do what he can or she can to fulfill the mission of the planners. And so they all show up they do exactly what they're told, right? So we don't have to worry about shirking or anything like that. Mises is saying, I can stipulate all that, and furthermore, let's assume for the sake of argument that the planners, when they're drawing up these blueprints for the grand economic plan, that they can call on experts from all the fields, like all the engineers, the chemists, the physicists, and so on, and they know the technological and physical trade-offs involved, right? So they know technically the resources they have at their disposal and what is physically possible for them to do with it. So they can't just give everybody a mansion and a limousine because there's not enough resources to do that given the technology. But they do know exactly what they are capable of producing. So that's what they're, so Mises is conceding all that. So you can see the point is he's really trying to make sure that he's taking all these other types of objections off the table, all right? And he wants to focus on what's remaining here, this real specific problem in socialism. And he said, even so, they can go ahead and publish the plan, and they can say, we have all these inputs. We have so much timber, we have all this coal, we have, you know, all these workers, workers of various skill levels. There's carpenters, there's medical doctors, there's people that don't really have any special skills, but, you know, they're able-bodied and they can be put to work at certain places. And we can come up with a plan that uses everything, right? It's not that we look around and see people just loafing around, or we see that, you know, coal is never going to be used ever, and so on. And we can produce stuff, and we can quantify it, and we can see, yep, we made this many houses, we made this many motor cars, yep, this many, the railroads deliver this many tons of freight. Okay, and then he said, we have no way of evaluating, even ex post, whether this was an efficient use of society's resources. There is no way to do it. There's no way to say, wait a minute, what if we rearranged things and used our resources differently to produce a different set of outcomes, that, you know, is that a better thing to do? Is that a better use of resources? And if you just, and he would often pick specific examples just to show that there's all kinds of ways you can produce something. So one I like to use just because it's pretty fanciful. So this isn't Mises' example. This is one I use just to kind of motivate the problem, is to say, imagine somebody's going to build an apartment building in a major city. And so there's different ways you could do it, right? It's not enough just to say, hey, we need to build an apartment building here. That would be good because people need a place to live. I mean, you need to be more specific. You say, okay, how would we build it? How tall is it going to be? How big are the rooms going to be? Is there going to be a weight room? Is there going to be a pool? Is there going to be coffee in the lobby? There's things like that. But even beyond that, just, is it going to be made out of brick? Is it going to be made out of wood and stone? Or is it going to be made? You could, in theory, coat all the rooms with gold, right? And that would be wonderful, right? Who wouldn't want to live in an apartment, you know, coated in gold? Imagine having your friends over there. You'd be pretty cool, right? So, well, you'd be popular. I think cool and popular are different things. We should talk about that later. So, all right, so you'd have an apartment coated in gold. And if you were in a fantastically wealthy society, maybe you would do that. All right, but we all have this intuitive sense that right now, given the condition of material scarcity in the world, and even in rich economies, having standard apartment units for the average person coated in gold, you know, large portions of the room is coated, that would be incredibly wasteful. That would be a poor use of resources. Okay, but the point is it would be hard to, you know, the planners would not have a feedback mechanism to know that. I mean, we kind of just know it because it jumps out at us as being absurd, but there's other decisions that it's not as obvious how absurd it is. So for example, how do we clearly, it makes sense that what would happen is places would grow oranges where it was, the natural conditions were conducive to that, right? So if we were centrally planning the U.S. economy, we would say, should we have any oranges at all? We say, yeah, I think given how much people like oranges and the fact that we can produce some and it's not that big a deal, sure, let's make some oranges. And even there, well, how many do we make? You see, once you start moving beyond generalities, it gets pretty tricky to come up with an objective way to say precise quantitative things. But surely we can agree we would grow more oranges in Florida than in Alaska, right? Even though it's technical, we could grow oranges in Alaska. You could set up greenhouses and do it up there if you wanted to, but we get the sense that that would be stupid. Why would we do that? Okay, so we're going to grow them mostly in Florida and other warm areas. We're not going to do it in Alaska. So does that mean people in Alaska don't get to eat oranges? And probably we would say, no, that can't be right. The plan has to allow. Well, how do we get them up there? Do we send them, you know, on a plane? Do we send them by train? So it's not obvious. You know, once you start getting specific, it's not clear. Surely you're not going to put a bunch of oranges on a supersonic jet in Florida to take them 10 miles down the road. That would clearly be wasteful, right? You'd use them by, you'd probably use a truck or something. But it's not as obvious if should you not use a plane at all to go from Florida to Alaska, because there's storage issues involved and, you know, maybe trains or whatever. You were not sure, do we have a train that goes the whole way? Or, you know, so would they spoil by the time they got there? So it gets tricky once you start getting specific. So I'm saying it's not enough. Even if you had all the information that Mises stipulated the planners, they could not look at one particular enterprise of decision, and then to say, is this helping contribute to the satisfaction of the comrades overall, or should we tweak what we're doing here? And this is just, you know, real simple stuff. More complicated things would be saying, what about building a new factory right here to make drill presses, right? So you're not just talking about stuff that's immediately contributing to the happiness of your people, but you're more building stuff that improves your infrastructure so that down the road you expand your opportunities for producing stuff then, or, you know, building, you know, a factory that's not cranking out consumer cars, but instead is making 18-wheelers. There, it's really tricky because no normal person directly likes the 18-wheelers. The reason it might be good and make sense to build them is that, oh, that's gonna make it easier for us to move stuff around down the road once these 18-wheelers come online, okay? So you see how there's all these decisions interlock with each other, and it's impossible in the real world for people to evaluate the plans even ex post. Right. And so the specific problem, the Mises says, you know, how is it that market economies solve this problem day in and day out, is that they have prices. And so the person considering, the retailer considering taking oranges from Florida and should we get them to Alaska or not, they have prices. That's how they make that decision. They can look at the different options and say, well, if we send it by rail for, you know, this part of the journey, these would be the costs of shipping. But that means the oranges would get there later than if we just flew them. Okay, how much do grocery stores in Alaska, how much would they pay me for oranges that were on the verge of rotting versus oranges that were really fresh? And so, you know, they could use pricing and they would just run the numbers. And the question they would be asking themselves is this likely to be profitable? And that's the way they would make the decision. They wouldn't say, is this a good use of society's resources? They would just say, looking at the narrow prices I have, is this profitable or not? Or to go back to the silly example of the apartment complex, the people building that and saying, do I want to coat the rooms in gold or not? Again, they wouldn't need to just say, oh, I know that's silly. Their accountant could come in and say, well, if we coated them in gold, we could sell the rooms for a higher price, right? People would pay more per month to live in an apartment coated in gold versus one that just had, you know, marbled surfaces and so on. So yes, it would make your tenants happier to live in an apartment coated in gold, but the problem is it's going to be a lot more expensive to build. And if we run the numbers, look at this, looking at the market price of gold or what we think it's going to be over the next few years as we build this thing, if you coat it in gold, your revenues will jump up because you can charge more to your tenants, but your costs of building the thing are going to jump up way higher. And so on the margin, that's a silly decision that you're reducing your profits, or what would actually be the case, you're going to suffer massive losses if you do that. So don't do that. All right, so again, it's the market prices would ultimately be the thing telling them not to do it. Because notice, it's not the case that, oh, no business person would ever use gold. That's crazy. That's too wasteful. Jewelers use gold, right? If a jeweler says, huh, I could make this necklace out of silver or out of gold, or, you know, coat it, and, you know, not that it'd be pure solid, but you can see jewelers could run the numbers and say, okay, yeah, someone would pay me more for earrings or a ring or whatever made out of gold and out of bronze. And so don't get your date a bronze earring. That doesn't go over well. So you see, so yes, there you still have that pattern where the consumer pays more for the thing coated in gold than something else. And the numbers work out such that the jump in how much they would pay more than covers the jump in the cost of production. So it is profitable to use gold in jewelry production, even though it's not, in typical cases, profitable to use it in apartment construction. And that makes sense, because the gold needs to be used somewhere. If nobody used gold, it'd be sort of a Yogi Berra thing that, oh yeah, no one uses gold because it's too expensive. That would be silly, then nobody would ever use it. So Mises says what market prices do in the real world is they're like a signal telling everybody this is how much this resource is valued in certain lines. There are some entrepreneurs who are willing to pay these high prices, and so it's a signal to everybody else saying, if you want to use this, really consider it carefully because it's needed elsewhere or it's useful elsewhere. And so the market prices on the means of production in the social nexus are a way with voluntary market decisions where people have property rights and just trade them voluntarily. It's a way that we can all sort of coordinate and make sure that resources that really ought to be channeled into certain lines are not wastefully allocated elsewhere. All right, so that's the way resources end up where they ought to be, or at least it's a method of doing so. And you could certainly come up with criticisms of that and say there's shortcomings of that approach, but at least there's some method to the madness. Whereas with outright straight up central planning without any markets at all for the means of production, they're just operating blindly. They really have no idea, putting aside whether they're, you know, actually good people at heart and want to help their comrades, or if they're, you know, power hungry dictators. Put all that stuff aside, they really just don't know how to use society's resources to effectively help people or to promote the most happiness among their citizens. Okay, so that's the critique of socialism, and you can see how to understand it, you end up understanding how market economies actually work and the importance of the profit and loss mechanism. And so, to be clear, obviously a lot of, just to circle back to what I said before, I'm not saying mainstream professional economists who get PhDs from the Ivy League schools are all a bunch of socialists, right? That's in the other departments they are. But most economists are not, and they understand the problems of socialism, especially now historically. But even there, I think it's not so much because of what their models did, it's just because they do have some common sense and they see history, and they can just kind of see with their own eyes. For some reason, socialist economies don't tend to work very well, and market economies do. But in terms of the models themselves, you know, that I learned at NYU and so on, there's no reason. I mean, a lot of these models don't even have money in them. Or if they do, it's sort of like they have to ad hoc get the model in, the money in there through some other mechanism just to make sure it's in there so that the central bank has something to do. But it's understandable if you didn't have that direct historical experience, if this was back before the grand experiments in, you know, China and the Soviet Union and so on had played themselves out, it's understandable why the top flight intellectuals of that day that Mises was grappling with were advocates of socialism and thought, you know, economic science shows us that it's a quaint historical accident that we tend to associate prosperity with market economies. Actually, there's nothing about economics per se pinning it down that it has to be a market. It could be socialism. So it's understandable because, again, their models didn't show that, whereas what I call Austrian economics, or what we now call Austrian economics, their focus on the market process and the importance of prices and how entrepreneurs use them to guide their decisions, that kind of stuff is not in a typical mathematical model. And so, but that's what's doing all the work. That's in the real world why market economies are so robust, because you have millions of decentralized decision makers, and yet there's a system that somehow coordinates all their activities, and they get feedback so that even if they do make a mistake, this operation's unprofitable, so they scale back and tweak it. And so now those resources that were formerly being wasted are now being returned to other uses so they can be allocated more effectively, right? So that's in practice how the market economy works, not that it's perfect or that at any moment it's in pure long-run equilibrium, but that it's got this feedback self-correcting mechanism. And if you just studied mathematical models of the economy, you would completely miss that. Okay, so last thing I want to talk about, and I think we'll have some time for Q&A formally, is business cycle theory. And so as far as nowadays, why do I think it's important for people who like economics to familiarize themselves with the Austrian school in general, and Mises in particular, is his theory of the business cycle. So it's now, people call it Austrian business cycle theory. Mises in his earlier work called it the circulation credit theory of the trade cycle. Right? But nowadays, when people say Austrian business cycle theory, they mean what I'm going to tell you about now. It was developed by Mises, and then his student's not really the right word, that Hayek, you know, wasn't sitting in a classroom with Mises. Hayek, you know, was already an economist who then was coming and then going to Mises' seminar. And so it's this work that was partly why Hayek won the Nobel Prize later on. Okay, so here, I like Hayek's formulation. I'm paraphrasing. He said, in order to understand what we're talking about, the business cycle, in order to understand how things can go wrong with the market economy, we should first understand how they could ever go right. All right. And so what he means by that is, instead of just jumping right into it and trying to understand how come there's a recession, you first need to study a normally functioning market economy to appreciate how complex it is and how there's all these things going on that we sort of take for granted. And then once you see how that thing works normally, then you have a much better idea and understanding what could cause that thing to slump. All right, it's sort of like, I don't know if this resonates with you guys, but when I was younger, I didn't understand how poison worked. Right? To me, the idea that it's really potent poison, you can take a little drop of something and I swallow it and I'm just gonna die. I didn't test it out, by the way, right? See, that's why I'm against empiricism. But could have killed me, all right? So, but it seemed crazy to me. Like, how could this little, you know, the effects seem disproportionate? But then what the problem is because you don't, or at least I didn't at the time, when I was a little kid, I didn't really know how the human body worked, right? And so really, the miracle, the amazing thing is not that this little drop of something could kill you. The amazing thing is that you're alive, right? That all these things that have to be going on within adequate parameters constantly to keep you from dying, right? That, you know, you're breathing in, you're getting oxygen in, your bloodstream is moving that around to all your cells, and so on. All this stuff that's going on just to keep you alive. And so once you see how complex all these systems are, then it makes sense how if you get introduce some foreign element into that interferes with one of those key processes, that could screw everything up and even, you know, kill the whole organism. So that's the analogy that I like to use to explain what Hayek is saying. So here, just to give you in a nutshell, where the Austrians are going to say the problem comes from is artificially low interest rates cause an unsustainable boom, and then when the central bank backs off and interest rates go back up, that causes a crash, right? So that's in a nutshell what it is, but I want to flesh that out for you so you can see where that comes from. So the first thing to realize in the Austrian view is that prices are really important. They do something, right? And that's why I picked the topics in this order. I want to hit the socialism point first so you can see what is it in a market economy that gives feedback mechanism? How is it that all the people, you just let them loose, you let workers work wherever they want to, you let people start businesses wherever, well, you want to open a pizza shop? Go ahead. You don't have to go get approval. Well, you do not have to get approval, but you know what I mean. In a free market, you wouldn't have to, and everything works. It's not like all of a sudden we're going to say, oh, shoot, nobody thought to make food this year. We all die, right? Because prices would provide signals, and as food got more, started running out, you know, prices would skyrocket, and entrepreneurs would realize, oh, there's profit opportunity, and you're making more food, right? So that's how this system gropes along, but actually ends up, you know, producing more and more every period in a typical fashion. It's the crucial role of prices in that process. So what is it that interest rates do, right? So interest rates, you could think of them in different ways, but they are a price. You can think of it as the price of borrowing money if you want to. Another way of thinking about it is like an exchange rate over time, right? So you could say, what's the exchange rate right now between the dollar and the euro or the dollar and the yen? But the interest rate is like saying, a dollar in 2016, how much does it trade for a dollar in 2017? And that ratio is one way of thinking about what's the 1 year interest rate, okay? So that's just ways of thinking about it, but the point is, obviously it involves time. You know, interest rates involve time, so it's not just right now what's going on market prices, how much do apples right now trade for oranges, but it's saying, if we make decisions over time, how do we relate those future activities and their economic consequences to what's going on right now? And in that, you need an exchange rate, right? Just like if you were a business and you were thinking about hiring workers here in the United States, building stuff in a factory, making a product, and then selling it in Europe. And so you could say, okay, all my expenses are in dollars. It would cost me such and such. Now I want to sell the product in Europe. I would earn euros in revenue. Well, obviously, a huge factor in that decision is what's the exchange rate between the dollar and the euro, right? Although, you know, you would need that information. Otherwise, you couldn't possibly compare. By the same token, if you're going to do something that, even domestically, that's going to take a long time to finish, you're going to build an apartment complex today or this year, spend $1 million this year building an apartment complex, and then rent it out to tenants over the next 20 years, your revenues are going to flow to you over 20 years. Your expenses are all up front. So you need some way of doing apples to apples to say, what's a dollar in the year 2018 that I'm going to get from a tenant then? How do I relate that to a dollar I spend today hiring someone to dig the foundation to start building this apartment complex? Okay, so the interest rate helps coordinate activities over time. And so in the Austrian view, when the central bank comes in and artificially pushes down interest rates by flooding the financial sector with money, yep, interest rates come down. That seems to stimulate activity, but it's unsustainable, right? It should not be doing that. People are investing in long-term projects that there's really not enough total savings to finish. And so that's not doing us any favors. That's just taking resources and putting them into particular forms that they should not have been congealed into. And so ultimately, you're going to run into trouble. And then when the central bank backs off is what typically happens, because price inflation starts getting too high, and then interest rates shoot back up, now all of a sudden we see the individual entrepreneurs run the numbers and say, "Look, this operation is unprofitable. We shouldn't have done this." They slam on the brakes. They, you know, lay people off. They cut back, or they stop altogether and go out of business. And so, in the Austrian story, that is ultimately what, why you get these booms and busts in the market. It's not because, oh, that's just capitalism. You got to deal with it. If we want to have innovation, we got to accept the fact that every 5 or 6 years we have this huge slump in unemployment. No. The Austrians say the reason for that is because you typically have waves of credit inflation that pushes interest rates artificially low, that gives this false appearance of prosperity. And then it's during this period that a lot of investment decisions are made that are wrong. And then the economy sort of paints itself into a corner. And at that point, there has to be an adjustment. People need to realize we are not as rich as we thought we were. And in the Austrian view, the way to deal with a recession is to not come in and push down interest rates again. It's just to let the interest rate go to where it needs to be, to give everyone the correct information, and then the market process will move resources around. Yes, it'll be painful in the short term, but ultimately we can get away from this boom-bust cycle if the government and the central bank stop fiddling with interest rates. All right, so that's the Austrian theory of the business cycle. Let me just end with, and I'll turn over for your questions in a few minutes here. I have a quote from Mises because, as I said in the little blurb in the, you know, advertising for this talk, it's not just that Mises was a technical economist. As I've tried to show you, he made major kind of, if he had just done any one of these three things I mentioned, people nowadays would still know him. But, you know, the fact that it was the same person that made all these contributions was amazing. But beyond that, he was a very passionate defender of classical liberalism, you know, human liberty in general, and he saw the connection that between economic freedom and all the other freedoms that we in the Western tradition cherish. And so he wrote, people quote this a lot, but in case you haven't heard it, I want to end with this one, then I'll turn over your questions. He said, "Everyone carries a part of society on his shoulders. No one is relieved of his share of responsibility by others. And no one can find a safe way out for himself if society is sweeping toward destruction. Therefore, everyone, in his own interest, must thrust himself vigorously into the intellectual battle. None can stand aside with unconcern. The interest of everyone hangs on the result. Whether he chooses or not, every man is drawn into the great historical struggle, the decisive battle into which our epoch has plunged us." All right, and so you can see why that's, you know, such a ringing clarion call for the people who believe in liberty and why they were so attracted to him, because not only does he have this great solid economic analysis that relied on contributions he himself made, it wasn't just these summarized other things, but he had these, you know, stirring calls and motivated people to learn these ideas because they were necessary in the struggle for liberty. So I will stop there. Thank you for your attention, and I'll turn over your questions. Okay, I think I saw you.
Can you talk about Mises' view on math and economics?
Sure, so, and I'm going to repeat the questions for the recording. So the question is Mises' views on math and economics. So he has some places in his book where he's really just excoriates it and says that he thinks that mathematical economics is at best byplay and that you're wasting your time doing that. He thinks ultimately economics, what it does is it's like logical thought experiments to show us cause and effect relationships, and that, you know, building mathematical models that really is not going to shed understanding on what it is that you're doing. The way I would, just to paraphrase or to give an example, for those of you who believe in free trade, just think back to what made you come to that conclusion or that position. It was probably because you read something like Bastiat's Petition of the Candlemakers, or maybe I think it was David Friedman came up with a great example where he said there's two technologies for making cars. One in the United States, one is to send workers to factories in Detroit, and you send steel and rubber and so on, and then and cars pop out. Another technology is you have farmers in Iowa grow crops, they put them on a ship, they send it across the ocean to Japan, and then 2 months later, cars come back, right? And so he said, why would we favor one technology instead of workers over another in terms of producing cars for Americans, right? So there's arguments like that I think, you know, in terms of you really getting it and seeing why free trade makes sense, it's things like that as opposed to come up with sophisticated mathematical models. Part of Mises' objection to using the approach that works quite well in the natural sciences, as Mises says, in the social sciences, there aren't constants, right? In natural sciences, there's like the speed of light, the charge of an electron, things like that. There are very few analogous things in the social sciences. People have free will, and so when we're trying to model, if you will, human behavior, Mises just thinks practically you're going to have a lot more success using the praxeological framework. Other questions? This person?
Yeah, my name is Trey Goff. Huge fan of your work, first of all. I listen to you on Contra Treatment all the time.
He says he's a huge fan of my work. I just want to make sure we get that.
No, I wanted you to weigh in more on the Bitcoin versus regression theorem.
Okay.
Specifically with Dr. Block's explanation, Walter Block's explanation regarding how regression theorem, he thinks, doesn't really apply to Bitcoin, because regression theorem is talking about a medium of exchange born out of a barter economy, whereas Bitcoin can basically piggyback off of the current price system already existing for the dollar. So what do you think of his explanation of that and your position on it?
Okay, so he wanted me to talk a little bit more about this issue of Bitcoin and some people saying Mises' regression theorem that we talked about in the talk shows Bitcoin can't be money, right? Because it wasn't like people were using Bitcoin for other reasons first and then said, oh, wait a minute, we could also use this as a medium of exchange. That's what it was designed to do from step one. I haven't read Walter Block's piece. He's saying that Walter, but it sounds plausible that Walter is saying, well, Bitcoin already had the monetary system that we've seen as an example, and so it piggybacked on that. That's one way of dealing with it. My quick thing, and then I think we have time for one other official question, is to say, if your position is that Bitcoin can't become a money because of the regression theorem, actually, you would have to say something stronger. You would have to say Bitcoin can't ever be a medium of exchange. And I didn't define that in the talk because I didn't want to get bogged down. But the idea is what Mises actually says, if you go look at his writings, is that it's inconceivable that something could be a medium of exchange without having previously just been valued for its own sake as a normal commodity. So a medium of exchange just means something that you take in trade. You know, you sell your horse, you get a bunch of eggs, not because you want to go make a bunch of omelets, but because you think I'm going to trade these eggs to someone else down the road to get what I really want. And so in that example, the eggs would have been a medium of exchange to you. They wouldn't necessarily be money if the community in general doesn't view them like that, but for that one transaction, it's a medium of exchange. So if you think Bitcoin can't ever become a money because of the regression theorem, you would also be forced to say it can't ever be a medium of exchange, but it already is a medium of exchange. There are plenty of people around the world who trade stuff to get Bitcoins, not because they're going to make a sweater with them, but because they're going to trade them away for something else. And so I'm just saying I think you're setting Mises up to fail if that's what you're saying. Okay, I think we got time for one more. Yep.
Last night, the girl from Pussy Riot was saying, she was like a Bernie.
No, you want the sex lecture. It's down the hall.
She was a Bernie Sanders type of person. And uh-huh. She was saying, she basically just wanted the government to pay for her dental care. And I think you get a lot of that today. Like, the so-called socialists, they don't want a totally government-controlled economy. They just want the government to pay for education and health care. How do you refute that?
Okay, so the question is, a lot of people today who call themselves socialists, they're actually not advocating full-blown central planning, abolishing private ownership of the means of drugs. It's just they really want a large interventionist state that takes care, has a huge welfare safety net, things like that. There, I would, in terms of relating it to Mises' work, he's got a great argument where he says there's no middle road between capitalism and socialism and the market economy and the planned economy, that if you try to stop halfway in between, piecemeal limited interventions just cause unintended consequences that even the supporters of the original intervention don't like and agree this is not adequate. And so the logic will push you towards either outright socialism or back towards capitalism. Just to give one example, with the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, this system's not working. Everybody can agree it's not working. As years of this continues, people are gonna be unhappy, and so they're gonna have to decide, are we going to go towards single payer or are we going to go back towards a more market-based form of health care and health insurance? But this current halfway, footsie where the government kind of does a lot of stuff, but there's still private health insurers, this clearly is not working. And so I think that's the way I would handle that. Okay, thanks everybody, and I'll be sticking around for further questions.
You've just finished another episode of The Laura Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Laura Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of LauraMurphy.com are not herein engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.